In 2003, an essay by John DeGatta was rejected by the magazine that commissioned it because it included factual inaccuracies. That essay, which eventually became the foundation of Mr. DeGatta's critically acclaimed book About a Mountain, was accepted by another magazine, The Believer, but not before the editor turned it over to the magazine's fact-checker, Jim Fingal, who... And that led to 7 years of arguments, negotiations, and revisions as the author and fact-checker wrestled over the boundaries of literary nonfiction. They have co-written a book about that experience called The Lifespan of a Fact, which includes Mr. DeGatta's essay along with their correspondence. It is published by W.W. Norton. I'm very pleased that it has brought John DeGatta and Jim Fingal to our show today. Hello.
Hello. Hi.
So, John, what was the topic of the original essay?
The essay was about a suicide that took place in Las Vegas, the suicide of a 16-year-old boy named Levi Presley. And I started, I first got interested in the subject because I was in town researching a different book. I was researching Yucca Mountain, just north of the city.
And where they were going to put nuclear waste?
Right, yeah. And my mom had just moved to Las Vegas. I was helping her settle there at the same time. And she recommended that I volunteer for the local suicide hotline, which she had done. And so I did, and I went through the training. And my very first night of volunteering, I got a call from a young-sounding person who ended up hanging up on me pretty quickly. But later that night, while home watching TV with my mom, I saw a news report of a boy who had killed himself by jumping off of the Stratosphere Hotel in Vegas.
And although you didn't know for sure, you thought it might be the same person.
My brain works that way, and I convinced myself that I had spoken to this kid, so I started researching who he was. And the deeper I dug
in... Not related to Elvis.
Not at all. And the deeper I dug into what happened to him, the more I found out about suicide in Las Vegas.
And that essay became part of your book About a Mountain, which mm-hmm. also dealt with Yucca Mountain?
Yes.
Jim, 7 years is a long time between accepting an article for publication and actually publishing it. Luckily, it wasn't about a topical subject. Why did the fact-checking and arguing take so long?
I guess the amount of time that I spent on it at the Believer magazine was shorter than that. The time in between when it came across my desk and I sort of turned in a final copy was somewhere around like the 6 months to a year, and then the 7 years was our extended conversation after that. But
was it published after 6 months?
It wasn't. So it was ultimately after about. Interning for about a year and a half, I had left. It hadn't yet been published then, and then was published. I think I started the process in 2005, and it was published like 2010-ish.
Right. So 5 years.
Yeah.
Can you explain how you approach an article as a fact checker?
Yes.
How do you determine what even needs to be checked?
My process was a little bit of guidelines and mostly intuition. I mean, it was. Knowing that my purpose was to break down every sentence into what could possibly be verified in terms of, both spelling and accuracy. If a sentence involves the Stratosphere in Las Vegas and it mentions the height of the tower and whatnot, those are all things that I can check.
Do you rely on the author's sources?
The sources are very helpful. I would say that it's a sort of parallel evidence gathering process where, I guess it really depends on the level of, how deep the fact checking needs to go for a particular institution, whether or not, you need a source or whether or not you need, five corresponding sources.
So what was it about John's essay that struck you as problematic?
It was originally.
Did he get the height of the Stratosphere wrong?
I think that the height of the Stratosphere was correct. I think there was a. It was presented to me as an essay in which massaging had been done, and I think what's surprised me was the extent to which it was done. So things like massaging quotations, sometimes changing quotations. attributing facts or sources to different people, sort of the range of different manipulations there.
Now, John, were these the same sorts of things that Harper's had objected to before they killed the piece?
Generally speaking, I think Harper's wouldn't want me to say this, but Jim's fact-checking was alarmingly more thorough than Harper's, which isn't to say they didn't do their job, but
well, they just decided not to run it.
They didn't decide to run it, but the fact-checking or the facts that were called into question by Harper's weren't anywhere near the number that Jim.
You must have heard that Harper's had had problems, which immediately red flagged this piece.
Yeah, well, and that's the interesting paradox, whereas if you're actually going for fact checking in order to decide whether or not you're going to publish a piece, you know, there's some minimum amount that you would come across before killing it. Whereas the Believer sort of accepted it and sort of knew where it came from and had a sense that that there were going to be these. Factual discrepancies, and my job was to sort of check it all the same. So there was sort of no point in which I was, you know, had done my job up until a point, because I was supposed to check the whole thing, and then the intention was it was to be published, you know, maybe with some changes, you know, maybe no changes, maybe putting the fact checking up on the internet, maybe posting it in the magazine, but there was no point in which I could cut off and say, like, you know, there were 10 things wrong here, and so, like, that's the minimum, and I can just stop now.
But at the heart of these conversations, John, is that you disagreed about the definition of nonfiction writing.
Yes.
So how would you define it?
I don't bother defining the term, because I don't really use the term. When I teach creative writing, and I put a moratorium on the use of that term in our classes. Nonfiction literally and etymologically means not art. You know, nonfiction coming from fiction. Fiction is derived from the Latin fictio, which means to shape, to arrange, to mold. And that's not just unique to fiction. That's a fundamental activity in any form of art. And so to suggest that there could be a literary form that does not arrange, does not shape, does not take the raw material of the world and try to find significance in it is, I think, not just impossible, but it also robs this genre of the possibility of doing what art is supposed to do.
But we assume that when we read Robert Caro's biography of Lyndon Johnson, that although he has shaped it through language, mm-hmm. he's pretty much giving us every fact that's there, and he hasn't shaped any of those facts. If he says it was in a memo, it was in a memo.
Sure. One of the, you know, what I'm saying in this book is certainly not that everyone who falls under the umbrella term, the unfortunate umbrella term of nonfiction, needs to be held to, I don't even want to use the word standards, but just follow the same rules. I'm not a journalist. So if I'm reading that biography, I'm going to come to it with certain expectations. If I'm reading a memoir, I am not approaching that book with those expectations.
Well, the two of you are sitting here together. You obviously are not at each other's throats. But in reading the book, the exchanges could get snarky at times.
They do.
Did you have to work that out?
I would say, I mean, a lot of the snark and the volume in the exchanges in the book are amped up a bit. I think.
What you mean? I can't trust this as nonfiction.
Yeah, on the back here, it's called essay/literature. So.
Thank goodness.
But I think that one of the interesting things is the creation of this book actually allowed us to have the sort of conversation about the things that we were engaging with that we didn't have when part of the, you know, the relatively professional back and forth at the magazine, and it also allowed us to, you know, maybe vent some of our frustrations in that snark.
Now, Truman Capote called In Cold Blood creative nonfiction, and he's telling us that he's playing with some of the a little fast and loose with the facts. But don't we as readers assume that a work of nonfiction will be 100% true or as close to the truth as is possible, even if there's a little shaping?
I think as an audience, yes, that's what our culture approaches everything in this genre as. I think that that's the problem with the term. Even the word creative slapped up in front of nonfiction doesn't really help anything. In my opinion, that's like, that is the definition of putting lipstick on a pig.
Well, Jim, in this case, the dialogue couldn't be verified as being 100% accurate, and some characters and events were obviously conflated. Are those the kinds of details that will confound a fact checker? Or don't you expect that sort of thing in an article of this sort?
Well, I guess not so much confounding. I mean, the fact checker's job is to find all of these things. You know, it's sort of neither unexpected or expected. You sort of come to each piece, you know, expecting that either it's entirely true or you know, entirely made up. And the work is fundamentally the same, whether or not you're fact checking a work of fiction or an essay or journalism. You know, what differs is what's done with it, the conclusions and the evidence at the end, and you know, perhaps probably influences the degree that to which you'll, you know, plumb the depths if you know you're fact checking fiction and you're only really out to check the proper nouns.
Well, as you can hear, fact checker Jim Fingal and writer John DeGatta are not at each other's throats at the moment, although when you read their book, The Lifespan of a Fact from W.W. Norton, you may wonder how they've worked things out. And I throw this out to both of you. Do you think it's possible to write essays that are a search for meaning but still conform to the factual level most of us expect from something that's called nonfiction?
Is it possible? It's certainly possible. Yeah.
Well, for example, if you were writing this as a newspaper article, you would have written it differently, wouldn't you?
I would have. Because when I read journalism, when I'm reading a newspaper, I go to it with those expectations. I rely on journalism. It serves
But this would be in a magazine. Wouldn't we expect something similar?
I don't turn to The Believer for my news.
Yeah, I know. You go to Huffington Post, like most of us. Do you think Jim, that the rules change depending on the medium? For example, some defenders of James Frye say that we should never expect a memoir to be 100% accurate. And then there was that recent flap between Ira Glass and Mike Daisy over whether his theater piece about the factory in China that makes Apple products should be held to the same standards as a work of journalism.
Well, I mean, the invoking of rules is interesting because that sort of asks the questions, you know, who makes the rules, right? And I think generally the you know, quote unquote rules are the rules of journalism are something that's sort of adopted by practicing journalists, and you know, they've it's something, a code that has been, you know, formally or informally agreed upon, and has a basis in historical practice. So, you know, it's not something which, you know, memoir was handed down from heaven with certain things that you could do and not do.
But memoir has the word memory in it, doesn't it? And memory, we all understand, has a certain amount of fogginess to it.
Right. So, you know, at the same time, even though there aren't, you know, objective God-given definitions of the term, there are, I mean, we do have different expectations when we come to this, the different genres. And I think that's one of the things that, you know, as a fact checker, I sort of butt against in the dialogue and in the book is this idea that, you know, like it or not, you know, depending how something is presented, depending what the label is on it, people are going to expect different things, be surprised if something breaks the rules.
Yeah. Well, Ira Glass said that as soon as they couldn't get hold of the translator Daisy worked with in China to check facts with her, the show should have pulled the story. But Mike Daisy, in his defense, said that his mistake was taking a theater piece, putting it on This American Life, and calling it a reported factual story. Now, do you think that This American Life should have retracted the story, and should it insist on total accuracy when David Sedaris and Sarah Vowell are telling their stories?
I mean, it's interesting because it seems like in the case of the Mike Daisy story that, you know, the primary thing that was taken issue with was almost that, you know, when engaging with Mike Daisy, they you know, communicated to them, you know, we want to present this as journalism, and we want it to read as something that literally happened rather than literarily happened, I guess. And that was the conflict. And the, you know, it's interesting to think about, you know, why there was such a strong reaction to that, whereas, you know, not all of This American Life is like that. And
well, we know that David Sedaris exaggerates. I mean, that's why those stories are so funny.
Yeah, just from the point of view of a listener too, if you come across a radio show like that and it's a work of fiction, that's not necessarily going to be flagged to you, you know, when you tune into the radio, or even guaranteed to be flagged before you tune to a different station. So it's interesting, the expectations there and sort of what's okay depending on, you know, what level of caveat happens or, you know, when that's communicated.
The cover of the book we're discussing, The Lifespan of a Fact, has in equal size type the title and then John DeGatta, author, Jim Fingal, fact checker. So all of those are key factors in considering this book. John, why do you need to fudge the truth? Aren't the facts dramatic enough?
I think what I would say is that, is that I'm trying to give the reader an experience. And I'm trying to, in this essay in particular, the essay that's being fact-checked in the book, I'm trying to answer a different sort of question than the question the essay begins with. It starts with what went on, what happened in Las Vegas, what happened to this boy. But it ends with asking a question about why this is happening. And the essay spends some time trying to interview various experts about why this is happening in Las Vegas. Why do people kill themselves to such a great extent in great numbers in Las Vegas? And it
is there a higher suicide rate in Las Vegas than other places?
It has the highest suicide rate, or it is at maybe
least. Usually because people have lost money gambling, I would assume. But was this kid gambling?
No. And gambling is in fact not considered a very high factor. And I should clarify, since we're talking about facts, when I was writing the essay, Las Vegas definitely had the highest rate of suicide in the country. It could be lower, it could be even greater now, but it's still among the highest. But what I came to realize in writing the essay is that I really couldn't answer that why by I wasn't going to get at an answer to that why by noting precisely how many strip clubs there are in Las Vegas or noting exactly how many seconds it took this boy to fall. I had to instead try to create an atmosphere, a feeling for the reader. And it's a feeling that is based on what I feel when I'm in Las Vegas. And that isn't verifiable.
Well, one point of dispute over your essay is your description of other events that happened in Las Vegas the day that Levi Presley killed himself. Mm-hmm. They didn't actually occur on that day. So why did you include them as happening on that day?
Well, that, I would say, contributes to the atmosphere of that day. So I suggest that I'm actually forgetting the facts. There was a woman who beat a chicken in a game of tic-tac-toe, which actually happened, but it happened sometime later that summer.
That's rare? And the chickens usually win?
The chicken, I think, always wins. Yeah, because it's actually a computer you're playing, and the chicken's just pecking some food that the computer lights up for it. So this was an event when the woman won $10,000.
Now, Jim, since they occurred around the right the same time, why is this a sticking point for you?
Well, I guess it's a sticking point. Whether or not it's a sticking point is a sort of question almost beyond the fact checker, right? The fact checker's job is to determine, you know, is there evidence for this? Like, did this actually happen? And then it's almost though I certainly get emotionally involved in the book, I think classically the fact checker's job is to be a sort of almost like a neutral third party who presents the evidence to, you know, the person who will make the decision and have the ultimate adjudication on whether or not that's a sticking point or whether or not that's close enough to be published in The Believer versus Harper's versus The New Yorker versus to be published in a nonfiction book versus, you know, to be published in a blog post or whatnot.
I'm sure The New Yorker would have forced you to change a lot of stuff. You actually were forced to change this to the published version in The Believer that said the summer that Levi Presley died, these things happened.
That's right.
Now, do you feel that somehow undermines the effectiveness of the piece, or does it really matter what's the same day of the or that summer? Because you're really talking about atmosphere, aren't you?
I don't think it undermines it, but I do think that saying on the same day these things happened and this boy happened to die is it provides a little bit more drama, but it certainly doesn't undermine the entire essay.
Jim, do you think that part of the problem is that we only have these two categories, fiction and nonfiction?
I think there are a large number of categories that are recognized by, you know, different numbers of people. So I guess I think there is a problem with categories.
Well, in the business, but not necessarily in the
right. So
the real
so as
world.
I think it is problematic, and that's what one of the things we get into is the idea that the casual reader or the public will have these only these two categories in mind. You know, whether or not that reader exists, that's, you know, what we have to butt up against.
Do you think that this also reflects a change in our attitude about what an essay is? An essay went into decline for a while because they usually were the sort of thing we wrote in high school that said sanitation is important to maintaining public health, and then you did this whole thing, and then you ended, and that's why sanitation is important in maintaining the public health. And now what we're seeing much more is the personal essay.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that what you're doing here, John, was somewhere between the journalistic essay and the personal essay? Is that what got you in trouble?
I think what got me in trouble is that the essay sounds and smells and quacks like journalism, but ends up being something else, that it signals to the reader that it's functioning like journalism, but as was my intention, it kind of pulls the rug out from under the reader, and that's what's problematic. We don't, just as Jim suggested, we seem in our culture at the moment to want to believe in the absolutes of fiction and fact, but as Jim's been saying throughout this discussion over the past couple months, if anything, that's a continuum. It's a very there is a very wide space between those two terms with a lot of variation between them and a lot of room for negotiation. But we seem to be more comfortable with the absolutes for some reason when it comes to this genre.
But there have rarely been absolutes, as I've discovered in doing this show over the years. Things that have been accepted as facts for, in some cases, for centuries, turn out not to be true. And even when they're revealed to not be true, they live on the internet.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that a problem if you publish something as fact and then it turns out not to be true? People reading your essay 20 years from now will say, "Gee, this kid died on the same day that the chicken." Lost the tic-tac-toe game.
I imagine if you're approaching the essay for that information.
But you know what I mean. Maybe that's not all that important. But there. But if we start relaxing the rules, then the next thing you know, we find bigger issues become blurred because we have accepted that kind of blurring.
I don't think in this book we're suggesting that the big issues or the facts surrounding the big issues should be blurred. I don't like necessarily the suggestion folks have made during this discussion that what we need are just more categories so that we know what we're getting, so that because we all fall under the umbrella term of nonfiction, a memoirist doesn't have to follow the same rules as journalism. It's too simple, but my solution isn't any better. My solution is a little idealistic and naive, which is to have no categories, to just let everything be literature.
But you have edited a book called The Lost Origins of the Essay.
Mm-hmm.
So are you thinking about how the essay has changed over the years?
In the book or in my life?
Yeah, well, and how did that apply?
Well, one thing I should note about that book is that it includes a good deal of poetry and a good deal of fiction, or at least texts, like William Blake's The Marriage of Heaven and Hell, that have traditionally been read as poetry. And that, in no way am I suggesting, is necessarily essay. But I include them in order to ask what happens when we put a text like this in the context of all these other essays. Do we read the text differently, and do we also read essay differently? And that's the point.
Jim, you're no longer working as a fact checker. You also worked at McSweeney's as a fact checker?
Yeah, McSweeney's and Believer is sort of the same entity producing mm-hmm. different things.
And now you're designing software.
Right, yeah.
Does it always have to be accurate?
You can't miss a semicolon or else it won't compile.
Jim Fingal and John DeGatta will be speaking with Heidi Julewicz tonight at 7 o'clock at McNally Jackson. That's at 52 Prince Street. The book, The Lifespan of a Fact, John DeGatta author, Jim Fingal fact checker, published by Norton. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Thank you.